Today I'm going to meet a boy, Jane Purdy told herself as she walked up Blossom Street toward her babysitting job. Today, I'm going to meet a boy. If she thought it often enough, as if she really believed it, maybe she actually would meet a boy, even though she was headed for Sandra Norton's house and the worst babysitting job in Woodmont. If I don't step on any cracks in the sidewalk all the way there, Jane thought, I'll be sure to meet a boy. But avoiding cracks was silly, of course, and the sort of thing she had done when she was in the third grade. She was being just as silly as some of the other 15-year-old girls she knew who counted red convertibles and believed they would go steady with the first boy they saw after the 100th red convertible. Counting convertibles and not stepping on cracks were no way to meet a boy.
You've just listened to the opening lines of Beverly Cleary's novel, 15. I'm John McCoy.
I'm Phil Gonzalez.
And this is Click-A-Cast, a Beverly Cleary podcast. And Phil, we have a special guest with us this time.
We do, because we're covering a book that deals with being a teenage girl. We both thought that it would benefit us, being men who were never teenage girls, to have a guest on who might have some insight into teenage girlhood. I am terrible at introductions. this is Alana Gravitz. Say hello, Alana.
Hi, thanks for having me. And I have indeed once been a teenage girl.
Oh, thank goodness. Okay.
You'll help us pick apart what might still be of interest to new readers and what is so charmingly specific to 1956 when this book was written, because this is Beverly Cleary's first in, I think it was 4 books for teenage girls she wrote starting in 1956. This is 15. We're going to run through a bunch of characters that may not be familiar to Ramona and Henry readers. Phil, do you want to fill us in on what this book's about?
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, you know, just background, just going through these books chronologically, it's neat to see, like, you can sort of pick up on Beverly Cleary trying new avenues. Like, you can definitely see where she made this choice, or her publisher made this choice. Like, let's try for teens now. And as you're going to find out in this book, like, this is not only a break age-wise, it's a break location-wise, because this is not, despite the title of our show, Click-A-Tat Street adventure. This is somewhere else in the Oregon territories. So, quick rundown of the plot. Jane Purdy is an happily average 15-year-old Portland girl living a suburban life in 1956. Her supportive family consists of a mother, father, and Sir Puss, a rather demanding cat. Jane spends time with her best friend Sandra, she dates her family friend George at her parents' request, and babysits her neighbor's unruly children for extra spending cash. It's on one such babysitting job that Jane meets Stan Crandall, newly arrived in town from the big city, when he stops by to deliver horse meat for the local doggy diner. Jane is immediately taken with the handsome, funny, and respectful boy and is completely caught off guard when he returns her interest by telephoning her at home and asking for a date. Suddenly, Jane finds herself thrown into the world of teenage courtship as she tries to navigate society's rules for dating while also navigating the imaginary standards she's set for herself, standards seemingly codified by members of the Cashmere Sweater Set, local golden couple Marcy and Greg. However, Jane's attempts to impress Stan with artificial worldliness continually backfire. She fakes her way through a coffee date, is unable to eat at a genuine Chinese restaurant in the big city, and can't even secure him as a date to the dance due to his already having promised to take a girl from back home. Even as Jane and Stan grow closer, she begins emulating the posturing and attitudes of her more experienced peers, all the while carrying on an internal debate with herself about who she really wants to be. While admiring Stan's new car, Jane impulsively kisses Sandra's on-and-off boyfriend, Buzz. Stan is appropriately taken aback by Jane's actions and seems sullen and distant while driving her home. Over the next few days, Stan stops calling, which Jane interprets as Stan not wanting to see her anymore. After working through the pain and disappointment, Jane comes out the other side with a new perspective. She decides to stop trying to be someone she isn't, someone she doesn't actually like very much, and instead be unapologetically who she is. It turns out that Stan wasn't avoiding Jane after all. He'd been rushed to the hospital for an emergency appendectomy. So Jane and Stan reunite, and on the night of the steak, bake, and movie at Woodmont Park, finally share their first kiss. Jane has discovered a new confidence in herself and has also secured the official title of Stan's girl. And that is 15 by Beverly Cleary. What did we think?
I'm going to turn to Alana here for the first word, because I came to this feeling a little bit like a voyeur. I never got this feeling before when reading Beverly Cleary, but I got it this time that this was not a book that was written with me in mind. And so I'm curious, Alana, how at home you felt with the story, and then to what extent maybe you felt like it was a time and a place as far removed from your experience as it might be from Phil and Maya's experience.
I definitely felt like it would have spoken to me if I had been a teen in the 50s. So it's interesting to hear that you felt like it was very distant, because I didn't feel that way, but it did seem very different from the novels that we have today that are aimed at teenagers, and also than the novels that I was reading when I was a teenager. But I think she did do a good job of capturing the excitement of the date and the worry, you know, before she goes on her very first date, that you hear a lot of description about everything she does to get ready and how many times she changes her outfit and how she worries about if her parents are going to look and behave acceptably. And all of those things felt very real to me. It was just very much set in the time and place that it was written, which, you know, if we're going to talk about if this would work for a kid today, I'm not as sure. But I think it worked for its intended audience.
I was just amazed at how many check marks this book checked off for 1950s teen culture. I grew up reading Archie comics, which take place in the Never Never Land of post-war America, and the Riverdale kids are perpetually living sometime around 1955, and so there are soda shops and sock hops and jalopies, and all of those things and more were in this book. There was a soda shop where some of the action took place. There was part of the storyline focused on the fact that Stan purchased a car, which turned out to be a Model A, which fascinated me. I looked up that those were out of production in 31.
Yeah, we did too. Like when we were reading it, we definitely looked up just because we wanted to see what's the back seat called?
Rumble seat.
The rumble seat.
So this would have been a car at this point that would have been at least 25 years old. So it's kind of the equivalent today of a kid buying their first car as like a 90 Toyota.
Yeah, one of the things I noticed was that if you were going to write something now and set it in the 50s, it would have come out a little different than having this actually written in the 50s. And as a reader today, I found that really fun.
Yeah, there's a level of authenticity. She's not trying, like John pointed out, like it hits all these things you expect from a teenage story set in the 1950s, but it does it with this casual air that only comes of something not being a period piece, but simply being a contemporary piece that you're looking back on with modern eyes.
Well, and there are things you wouldn't think of. I was just rereading the section where she gets ready for the date, and her mother says, "Well, Jane, didn't you just wash your hair the day before yesterday?" And I was like, oh, that's what we do then, I guess.
You know, right.
And you have a closet full of clothes. Why do you want a new dress? And she has literally five dresses. Like, things were just different in ways that we wouldn't, you know, the rumble seat, yeah, we think about that. Nibley's, the soda shop, we would think about that. But then there were other things that I didn't even know were part of being a teenager in the 50s.
Yeah, especially like the exoticism of the big city and the exoticism of things like Chinese food. Which really stood out to me in the Chinese restaurant chapter. Like, I know we read the book out loud and I was just constantly stopping and just being like, what? I don't understand the attitude towards this. It was a remarkably like progressive attitude, considering like my own prejudices and what I think your average white American thought about outside cultures in the 1950s. It was remarkably progressive and open-minded, but also like, this was definitely a foreign culture to these kids. But then I imagine that, like, kids today, if you got sent into, like, an authentic Chinese restaurant situation, like a non-Americanized Chinese restaurant, might be taken aback just as much. So who knows?
What would be kind of universal about the story is Jane's desire to present herself as a sophisticated and urbanite young woman to Stan and to everyone else in the book. But what you also see here, I think, at the beginning with Jane's, in the first chapter when Jane goes babysitting at the Nortons, is you see this kind of a burgeoning kind of, I kind of pictured the Nortons as almost beatniks. You know, they're not quite there, but they're sophisticated insofar as they lived in France, and they have a house where everything is antiseptic and modern and new, and there are paintings on the wall that she says are made of drips and drabs. These are bohemians, by at least by the standards of suburban Oregon at the time.
Yeah.
and I think that's fascinating to me that to see this coming out just in the same way in Henry and I guess it was Ribsy, when there was the passage about Mr. Grumby having the barbecue. Here there's a kind of a little bit of a dig at sort of the fact that the Norton's child is such a holy terror comes out of the fact that she's had a kind of a permissive and traveled life.
It's that post-World War II where we're all experienced, like the world is kind of a little shaken up. The idea of what it means to be a successful, like, working class American has changed. And it's a little bit reflected, like what we saw in the Ramona book with the art teacher who teaches Beezus's class, who's like a little bohemian and a little like artsy fartsy. We're seeing what seems to be sort of a reflection on the mixes of different lifestyles. And the slight, the income gaps between families are standing out a little bit more. Like the people who have are definitely flaunting what they have a little bit more than I think they had been in the past. I'm not sure if I'm making any sense, but I think it's partly comes from Beverly Cleary's firm grasp of like the economic disparities between children's families. She always paints that really well.
I think she did that in some really interesting ways, because Jane, as she walks through the neighborhoods to get to different babysitting jobs, she'll explain to you that this is the part of the neighborhood that's the, what is it, the veterans...
Right, veterans no down payment for veterans,
right,
whatever.
Right, and, you know, like, based on where people live, she's really aware that Stan needs to have a part-time job, and so does she, where other kids don't. Like, and that's something that I do see, that I think is cool about Beverly Cleary in general. Well, and she points out those economic differences.
And I think that's one of the things that keeps Beverly Cleary's writing universal, is that's an issue that teenagers still are very aware of. Like, you're very aware of, you know, where do you fit on the economic ladder? And it doesn't necessarily build a wall between you and your friends, but it's definitely something that you notice. Like, who can afford to have their own phone? Who can afford their own car? Who gets to go to the movies whenever they want versus who has to save? Who has to have a job versus who chooses to have a job for spending money? Yeah, and I think that because Beverly Cleary has always been very committed to the internal lives of her characters rather than just the trappings of the story, that's, to me, what makes them continually readable and accessible. Because, like, our kids, like the kids in this household, were intrigued by the book as we were reading it. Like, a 15-year-old and a 5-year-old both were taken by what was happening
when we read it out loud,
because the narrative voice seems so authentic. Yeah,
some of this has to be informed by Cleary's own experiences. She grew up in the middle of a farming community and an old farmhouse, and her family moved to Portland, and she probably felt a little like the country mouse coming to the city herself. And she had a lot of economic insecurity as she started out herself. Of course, she later went on to become a huge success. One of our fans, one of our super fans, Amy Pascal, sent in a wonderful cassette that was a interview with Beverly Cleary, and the interviewer asked her what she liked about having money, and she just kind of said, "Well, I like not having to worry about money, but that's about it."
Oh. Well, and she would have been 40 when this book came out.
Yeah.
So she's writing a teenage perspective. She's writing about teen life, but she would have been a teenager in, like, the... I'm trying to do the math in my head.
Well, did she have any kids?
She had two kids.
Because I'm wondering if her kids, or her friends' kids, you know, would have been about 15 when she wrote this. So it would have been written perhaps from that perspective, which is kind of interesting to think about when you think about the parents in this book. I really liked watching the narrator, you know, Jane, the main character, talk about her parents. But of course, knowing this book was written by someone the age of the parents, and now being in the parent position when, you know, I would have read this as a teen, but mm-hmm. now I'm seeing the parents' view. And I found that really amusing. The way the parents were handled was very cute.
Beverly Cleary had twins in 1955, so they would be 1 year old when she was writing this.
Wow. Wait, so does that mean she had kids when she was 39?
She must have. Go Beverly Cleary.
Yeah.
No kidding.
That's
interesting.
It is interesting, but it does mean that she was writing... So she was writing this solely based on her own experiences and her own, like, I guess, as a writer, like her powers of observation.
Well, and again, if she had friends, that would be the age of many of her friends' kids.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I suppose I could write a book about a 15-year-old. It involves a lot of sitting and looking at your hands while you play a video game. Like, that's easy. I can do that.
I really do appreciate Jane's character and her interior life. I do have to admit, I did not find the rest of the kids as easy to picture. You know, I always had an easy time as a kid picturing all the characters in the Henry Huggins books and in the Ramona books. There was kind of an interesting secondary cast of characters. Jane is marked mostly by this interior desire to present herself as a sophisticated young woman. You know, she's very... The title 15... is brought up again and again because she feels that she's at an age where she's not quite old enough to be the sophisticated young woman she wants to be, that she's still kind of a kid in her head. And that's, of course, I think something you, when you're a kid, you keep thinking that that next milestone is going to be the one where you're just going to get to that, past that hurdle, and everything's going to fall into place. And then you get, you know, to the point where you get out of high school and you think, when I get into college, everything's going to fall into place. And then you get out into the world and you think, now that I'm in my young 20s, everything will fall into place. And it keeps happening and happening. And, you know, and then some point around, I guess, 35 or 40, you just give up on that whole notion if you're smart. But so I appreciate her struggle. I have to admit, I found some of the other characters a little bit bland, especially Stan. I have to say, he seemed like a sweet kid, but more as kind of an idea of a boyfriend to me.
Mm.
I actually noticed in general that there was some tension that was perhaps done with the reader in mind between, did Jane want Stan, or was she excited to have a boyfriend because of the social capital it would bring? I mean, in some ways, Jane's kind of shallow. Like, she's excited when he gets a car because she wants to be seen with a boy in the car. They go out on the first date and she wants to go to Nibley's and be seen by everyone. And she goes through in her internal dialogue, should we sit in the back where I'll have him all to myself? Or should we sit in front where I can show him off to everyone? And I'm not sure how much she's really into Stan versus having a boyfriend that she actually likes as opposed to George that her parents make her date.
Yeah. I think that might be a little bit, like a little on purpose. It seemed to me that she was letting that aspect of the relationship, the social capital aspect, sort of cloud her vision the whole time. Like, because she is living in this, like, completely internal world with almost a complete disregard. Like, she's not noticing the things Stan is even doing until he, like, deliberately, like, gives her a back scratcher. Like, makes a gesture on his part. He seems to... All the characters, the vagueness almost seems like a reflection of her living in this bubble until the end when she breaks out and chooses to be herself and actually engages with the characters for the first real time when she's carrying the giant bouquet of flowers and she's being a little snappy, but actually the kids stop seeming like archetypes and just start seeming kind of like just jerky kids, like hanging out. Like all of a sudden those stereotypes begin to crumble away as she stops trying to pretend to be someone she's not. And then she really like interacts with Stan for the first time on even footing, I think, when they're at the steak and bake, like, and she's being unself-conscious and like making a mess of her chewy steak.
Some of the epiphanies she has are the moments where she lets go of what she feels ought to be happening in this relationship or what she imagines a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship to be, and when she actually acknowledges Stan as a person with all kinds of insecurities of his own. One of the first times that happens is very early on in the story where she notices Stan getting on his bike that he's hidden in the bushes because he doesn't want anyone to see that he had to bike over to her house and he didn't have a car to drive at that point. And she suddenly realized that Stan was just as concerned about appearances and propriety and worried about what her parents would think as she was about worrying about what her parents would think. And I think that this happens again and again. And as you say, I think at the end of the book, the growth in character is that she lets go of this concern, this overriding concern about how her relationship to Stan acts as what Alana, you call social capital or the projection to the world, and is more concerned about, you know, Stan as a person. But on the other hand, it's not, I have to say, the other thing that I admire about this book is it has that wonderful, clear dryness. It's ostensibly a romance, but yeah. It is not about a fiery, tormented first love romance. This is not, you know, Judy Blume.
I was just going to say, this is not Judy Blume.
You get the feeling that the stakes are a little bit low, partly because at this time, as my mom used to say to me when she was a young girl around this time, you were not encouraged to date one person exclusively and certainly not passionately.
Well, that's one thing that we noticed. Like, in the very beginning, her parents are concerned that she might date this one guy. And it's such a flip on what I think parents are, like, supposed to be concerned with. Because you don't want your kid playing the field. You'd rather them just, like, be with one nice boy. We noticed that, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
I think that would be an interesting thing to see how kids today view the social dynamics of dating at this time. Because when we all were teenagers, there was more of an expectation that you were with one person exclusively while you were with that person, whether or not you were actually engaged in any physical aspect in your relationship. As a teenager, you were kind of expected to be at least emotionally exclusive. And I don't know what kids today are doing. I mean, I do know a lot of people in their 20s and you know, in college and stuff, and they all talk about hookup culture being like, again, it seems like we've moved to a new time where kids are not dating each other exclusively. I don't know. I don't know how a teenager would react to the dynamics of the expectations of dating in this book.
It's the one part of the book that I had no real like grasp on, because there are so many, it seems like dating and dating culture has a lot of really arcane rules and regulations in this world that I didn't even know how to begin researching. Like, there were things that were just understood as givens to the reader. that Beverly Cleary didn't go out of the way to explain. And
I don't know if any of us, I mean, I think that there is still an expectation that you would see one person at a time. It just might be short. It might be for a few weeks. But you see that person, and then you two decide you're done.
What's with the whole George, the friend of the family? Like, you need to be dating someone. Like the...
Oh, I'm talking about now. Yes.
Oh, now.
Yeah,
oh, I see.
Yeah. Because we were hypothesizing if that was true today.
Oh, right. Because it's so weird, because there's that thing, though, where her parents want her to be dating. Like, you need to be going out with boys, even if you don't like them. Here's just a boy. And not only does it seem to be, like, something her parents are, like, big on, like, the other kids are like, well, I don't like this guy. I'm thinking of Buzz in particular. Like, he's kind of a jerk, but it's better than no boy.
You know what, though? I'm trying to remember the name of it. I read that Aziz Ansari book about romance.
Oh, yeah,
that?
Yeah.
And one of the things he did is he looked at, over time, how did people meet the person they married? And I remember looking at people my grandparents' age, which I think is not actually quite the same as this book. But a huge number of people married someone within a 4-block radius of where they live.
Mm.
And it was really clear that this, now we have this, like you guys were saying, passionate romantic ideal. It wasn't that. You find someone, it kind of like her parents said, you know, he's got good interests. He likes science. He'd be a good match for you. And that was what you did. You didn't pine for the true love of your... It wasn't a Romeo and Juliet thing. You would find someone who seemed pretty good, and when you were the right age, you'd get married. So
yeah,
that actually
yeah, yeah.
fits that paradigm really well. It is quite different from how we see things today.
I agree, and I think that there was this culture of the schools and the churches and the organizations would put on these social events like dances and such.
Yeah.
And the idea was you practiced at having relationships, and everything was very casual. And the idea was that you were trying out different people to just kind of see what kinds of people you'd be interested in, which is one of the things why I get the feeling that the passage that you mentioned where Jane kisses Buzz, that may actually be supposed to be read as a little bit more scandalous than perhaps mm-hmm. a modern reader might think. I think the idea was this was the peer pressure moment of the book, where she was really trying, or maybe not external peer pressure so much as an internal pressure mm-hmm. Jane felt of wanting to present herself as a very exciting and
worldly.
Yeah, or, you know,
yeah.
It reminded me, you know, when I was a teenager, I used to hang out with a group of boys and girls, and at lunchtime we would all sit out on the field out behind the band room where there was a big high jump porta pit that we would all sit there and lie around. And one of the girls had a collection of these ridiculous Playboy novels, and she would read aloud to them, and it seemed very, very daring and very you know, like, oh, how are we going to get into trouble for this? You know, you're trying out sexuality long before you actually have sexuality.
Right.
And
right.
I feel like that's kind of what Jane is trying to do here. She's trying to be you know, an exciting person, and she ends up hurting Stan's feelings. I think she also ends up kind of I don't think Buzz is any great shakes. So,
well, she ends up hurting Sandra's feelings too, because Sandra was standing right there.
An odd moment in the book when Buzz said, "You know, for 50 cents, I'd kiss your girl."
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he's kind of a scuzzy guy, and I think they do a pretty good job. Beverly Cleary does a good job at selling Buzz as someone who's scuzzy. But scuzzy in that teenagery way. Like, he's not a bad person. He's just, he's trying to be that guy. Like, he's trying to be the funny one, and he's not funny. And he tries just like Jane, like, just tries too hard to be that guy. And I can see, like, in the future, like, Buzz just kind of, like, settling in and just being just another jokey dad, like, around town. But I agree that moment, the kiss, has a huge weight. And it wasn't actually until that moment that I realized that they hadn't kissed. That she and Stan had gone through all these dates and were going to the movies and were going to the city and doing all this stuff. But the big moment they were waiting for this whole time was the kiss. And that's what meant something. Like, that sort of sealed the deal.
Do you think she had ever kissed George?
Oh, God, no.
But she'd been on many dates with him.
Many dates. But yeah. I think that's the thing. I think dates meant something different. Like, date wasn't like a lead up to physicality. It was a social, like, convention. It was like going to the ball, or, you know, like, or being presented at a dance. Like, you followed certain rules.
I think all those dates were just George showing off his schist to her.
Yeah.
he definitely was written with a bit of a who was the guy from Archie, the little nerd from Archie comics?
Oh, right, the one with the glasses and the bow tie. I forget.
Yeah, Deltoid. I can't think of his name. It's not Deltoid. Sorry, everyone.
Well, and going back to what one of you were saying earlier, a lot of the characters in the book are archetypes and not really fully fleshed out.
Yeah,
and I think he's one of them.
Yeah, and is that because that's what the way is that Beverly Cleary just not writing in-depth characters, or is it because we're seeing it from Jane's perspective and she's not giving these people the thought that they deserve? It she's not thinking of them as real people, she's thinking of them as archetypes in her little society,
or maybe even an attempt to focus the reader on Jane without too much distraction. Maybe you just need to know that Marcy and Greg are the cashmere sweater set, and then you can peg them, you know, sort of like the Breakfast Club. You know, once you know who everybody is, then you can move on.
Yeah, because it's really about Jane's internal development more so than, like, this fun neighborhood of characters.
Yeah, it's not an ensemble.
No, it's definitely not. It's definitely not.
The last book we read, the Beezus and Ramona, was a kind of a huge leap forward for the internal monologue for Cleary. This book is almost entirely internal monologue.
Jane wondered what she would do about Stan if she were some other girl. If she were the kind of girl who went to school with her hair in pin curls, she would probably telephone the disc jockey at station KWOO and ask him to play Love Me on Monday to Stan from Jane. If she were intellectual like Liz, she would probably say the dancing and riding around in a Model A Ford were boring or middlebrow or something, and spend the evening writing haikus for a manuscript. Or if she were the earnest type, she would write a letter to Teen Corner in the newspaper. The letter would begin, "Dear Anne Benedict, I wonder if you could help me solve a problem. Recently I met a boy." If she were the cashmere sweater type, like Marcy, she would date several other boys and forget Stan.
Quite frequently, we get several pages of Jane imagining what needs to happen on this coming date, or what she needs to do to present herself well to the group of friends. And then something else happens, and we get several pages of her being terribly embarrassed by that. And then there's kind of a turn where she realizes maybe it wasn't so bad after all, because this happened. You have to really be happy to spend a lot of time inside your main character's head, because that's all you're going to get from this novel, pretty much.
And the writing form, looking at where she is in her career, is still a little closer to that episodic. Each chapter could almost stand alone as a short story. It definitely has an overarching theme and some push to it, but a lot of the first chapter is Jane versus the horrible babysitting kid, and then the next chapter is Jane versus the first date, and then the next chapter is Jane has to go to the city, you know, and they're almost like a string of pearls making a necklace that do string together in the end, but it's still really, I don't want to say it's not choppy, but they're little.
They could be episodes of a Netflix series that tells like a complete story over like 7 episodes.
Yeah, which feels like some of the books, the earlier books that you guys have talked about.
I think as a writer, she's still, well, I don't think she'll, I mean, she writes fiction for young people, so I think she'll always sort of stick with that, because, you know, as Terry Pratchett said, like, he didn't understand, Terry Pratchett never understood why adults needed chapters in their books anyway. And so he never wrote chapters in his book. He's like, we're grown-ups. We know where we are in a book. He only wrote chapters for his kids' books because they needed to, like, remember how to keep track of where they were in the story. And I think she'll always maintain a little bit of that episodic. Each chapter will always kind of tell a little story. But I definitely see what you're saying. Like, these are, and as John said, like, these are events, individual events, framed by her internal monologue, and then how does that affect her positioning with Stan?
Like, and her social position.
And her social position. I was a little disappointed at the end, knowing that we'd never ever meet Jane again, like in the books. Like, she's never appears as a character, or she's never going to get her own book again, because each young adult teenage book that Beverly Cleary writes is about different characters. But I also understand, and now thinking about what John said and what you said, like, it wouldn't make any sense to write another Jane book, because this was, they didn't flesh out any other characters, and this was about this one revelation she had, which was, stop trying to be someone else, embrace who you are, and not necessarily things will turn out for the best, but at least it will have been you doing it.
Yeah, I agree. I do wonder where things might go from here if Cleary had been a slightly different kind of writer. I think that we brought up Judy Blume before, and I think it's a really interesting comparison because Blume adores Cleary. She's gone on record as saying that Beverly Cleary was one of the reasons she became a writer. And Blume wrote for kids, she wrote for teenagers, and then she ended up writing for adults. And famously, she wrote some pretty explicit and intimate books for adults. And Cleary is just not that kind of writer. And I always wonder what would happen if we would follow someone like Jane actually into young adulthood. There was a tantalizing moment in this cassette interview that I got where the interviewer asked Cleary, have you ever thought of writing a book for adults? And Cleary said, oh, I have an idea for one. And of course, this was the best I can tell, this interview was sometime around 86 or 87. And so, of course, it never saw the light of day. You know, Cleary is still alive. She's sitting on a manuscript.
I was just
going to
say, like, she's 100 years old. One day, maybe she will no longer be on this earth, and they'll open her safe, and we're going to find some of the most progressive science fiction that's ever been read by human beings. It's going to be just amazing, far-seeing, dynamic action science fiction that's going to change the way we look at the world. Now, I just think that she always seemed to just, she, it seems almost like she had a job, which was to write dynamic literature for young people. Like, she saw a need when she was starting out that, like, kids weren't getting decent books that they wanted to read. And, like, it sort of seemed like she was like, fine, then this will be my thing. I will make sure there's always a good book on the shelf for young people to read. Adults get all the good writers. Let's respect kids and write true to life stories for them. Also books about mouses that ride motorcycles, but we'll get to those, but mostly books about the internal lives of children as important creatures on this earth. And I think that comes through in this book. Like, she's not making fun of the teenage experience. She's not criticizing it. She's compassionate. She's writing a compassionate novel about one kid's experience as a teenager that, to me, rings true. Like, it comes from a good place, like an honest place. It may not be the most exciting book in the world, but it held my attention.
She's also writing about a normal kid, and that was one of the things I found the most interesting.
Right.
Because in today's literature aimed at teens, it's all about the outsider and the kid who's in a terribly extreme situation, or, you know, the kid who's a wizard, or, you know, things that... And in today's culture, we all want to believe we're the outsider.
Yeah.
And Jane is not an outsider. She doesn't come from the wrong side of the tracks. She's a regular, what are they, her parents call her sweet and sensible, which she hates, but she actually is. And I think it's really cool to have a main character who's interesting and very normal. She's not particularly smart. She's not particularly dumb. She's not particularly gorgeous, but she's not hideous. She's just a girl.
Yeah, she doesn't stand out to anyone. Some people know who she is. Like, she's not... Yeah, she's not... She is delightfully average. And, yeah, she's not the chosen one. She's not...
She's not on a quest.
Yeah, she's not Bella from Twilight, who's just so beautiful but doesn't even realize it, and that's why everyone can't stop looking at her. Like, it would, and that's a book series that's told from the perspective of the teenage girl. Like, it's in her voice, and it never rings true because she is the teen, like the ultimate teen that we're all, like, that all teens come from, that we all want to be. And, like, she's the, but Jane is just that kid down the block, just like all the other kids that Beverly Cleary was. I mean, maybe Ramona stands out as somewhat exceptional, but only in that little, like, on that one block, because there's Ramonas everywhere. Everyone knows one. And so I think even Beverly Cleary's outstanding characters have that quality, that sense of normalcy. Like, they are outstanding because there's always someone who's a little outstanding.
The one question I would have after having read this book is, I found it pleasant enough. I didn't find it, you know, revelatory as like, wow, I really missed something by not reading this book in my childhood. But I found it charming and I found it interesting. But on the other hand, I've got a lot of skin in the game here. I am such a fan of Beverly Cleary that we started a podcast about her together. And I am also the kind of person who loves reading antique things to find out how life was different then. Is this the kind of story that you think a kid today would be able to pick up and read and get enjoyment from, though? I mean, I think that when you're a teen, you may be at the point of life where you're the least interested in what life might have been like back in the 50s, or least interested in finding out about dating customs that have nothing to do with your own burgeoning sexuality. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think, I mean, you said that your teenager was interested.
Definitely.
But probably wouldn't have picked it up. That's what I think is interesting. If you were already reading it out loud to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I think this very question is reflected in the variety of book covers that publishers have used on this novel in the last 60 years now. Like, if you look, I made a little JPEG that I just combined a bunch of the different covers they've used over the decades, which is, they have tried to sell this as everything from a intimate soda shop comedy to a passionate teen romance to a that girl-esque, like, wacky look at suburban life. Like, just the way they graphically depict these characters on the covers of the books in many of the same situations at a soda shop says that that they're desperately trying to gain teens' attention. But I also think it stands out in that this book has stayed in print. Like, this is not a book that got forgotten by publishers. Like, it's still, you can buy new copies today. Her four teen novels are still in print. I think that people recognize that this is a more universal story than a teenager might think, which is why they keep trying to disguise it so that teenagers accidentally pick it up and enjoy it. But like Alana said, like, the teenager in this house was totally engrossed in what was going on. It still involves situations and scenarios that a teenager can relate to. And as a parent, I find the final message of the book, as stereotypical as it is, it has that, like, just be yourself. Like, that's the overall, like, at the end of the day, the net message is, be yourself. Stop trying to be someone else, which is, you know, every single Disney movie delights in telling us that. But what makes it stand out to me in this book is that it isn't be yourself and you'll discover how amazing you are. It's be yourself so you can just relax and stop worrying. Because you're not perfect. You're going to make a million mistakes. But that's okay, and you'll get through it. And to mention boy wizards, in one of the Harry Potter books, he drinks a potion that gives him luck for a whole chapter. It gives him perfect luck so he can achieve whatever he's setting out to do. And it reminds me a whole lot of this chapter where Jane decides to just be herself. Because Harry Potter manages to make it through mostly by confidence. It mostly just instills him with unflagging confidence and sort of opens his perceptions. And that's what happens in this book, too. When she opens her mind and just says, I'm just going to do everything exactly like I would do it, she becomes alert and is able to talk to people and is able to be funny and witty effortlessly. And it doesn't seem like a joke or a jibe or... it doesn't seem manipulative on the author's part. It seems genuine. And I think that's a good message for teenagers, which is maybe if you stop worrying about being someone else and just embrace the fact that you are imperfect and that you are you, maybe the world won't... Those daily interactions won't be as difficult. And I think that's a good thing for a kid to read.
That's a very positive note to end on. I'm going to end on a typically nerdy, geeky note for me, which is the edition that I read was the Kindle edition, which has no illustrations. But if you are the kind of person like me who is obsessed with old illustrations, do look up the original illustrations by Joe and Beth Crush, who were best known for their work on the Borrowers series, if you remember the Borrowers.
Yeah.
And they are immensely charming illustrations, very Atomic Age style illustrations that I just adore.
Yeah, and they're left out of all new editions. You can't, any print editions in the modern day does not have them. I think probably as a reflection of what teenagers expect from a book now. I think it makes them look a little too young to have drawings every few pages. I think a modern teenager will see drawings and think they're picking up something for younger kids, which is a shame because they are really cool, but you do have to seek them out. Did you have any final thoughts, Alana?
I really don't. I feel like I should have something to say. I don't. I wouldn't have read this if it wasn't for this podcast, but it was a sweet, sweet book.
Yeah. No, I'm happy to have read it. I've never read her teenage stuff, and because I thought, what interest do I have in reading a book from a teenage girl's perspective? And which is weird because I've read Judy Blume and stuff like that, but maybe I just didn't want to shatter my view of Beverly Cleary as a elementary school writer, someone who I grew up with in elementary school. I didn't want to read her stuff for older kids. It seemed like they have their own books. I wanted her to write books for when I was a kid, but I'm having opened that door now. I'm looking forward to exploring her other teen books and just seeing where it goes from there.
I'm sad there's no more Jane. I didn't realize they were all about different characters.
Maybe the show pop. Maybe she pop. I don't know if the other books even take place in the same block or universe or I don't know how connected they are, but maybe she pops up. Oh, there goes that Jane. She's so confident and so much herself.
Well, next time we'll return to Clickety-Tat Street with Henry and the Paper Route, and I can regale you with the stories of the many paper routes I had. I think
oh,
I
no.
was the last American boy to have a paper route.
I expect a street-by-street breakdown of your favorite routes.
Okay. Well, we'll end here.
Great. Okay.
Thanks to Alana Gravitz for joining us, and to Shannon Camp for playing Jane. Clickacast is brought to you by the Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts at theincomparable.com.